Good morning. Welcome to Jay's Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. You got your headphones in? You ready to
really
roll?
I really locked in Julia Kreutz with you today.
Julia's a big expressive sire in general. A really big one as we came on air today. How you doing? You all right?
No, I'm doing all right. Listen, you know I was in game coverage yesterday, so it was a late night for me. You also know I had my story ready to go, and then the Blue Jays walked it off, which is
rewrite.
Not a recipe for a fun evening or a fun morning. Obviously, it was a very fun game, but I will say that you and I had very, very different experiences at the ballpark yesterday.
We did. I'll mention off the top here, by the way, we're going to take some of your texts today. We do have Michael Bauman of Fangraphs coming on. We've got Ashley Stevenson, a Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer and a coach with the Dunedin Blue Jays, coming on with us a little later as well. But in the second segment, we'll take some of your texts. So text us 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Let us know how you're feeling. Throw us some questions about the current Toronto Blue Jays. We have some leftover from last week as well. I had to filter out the ones that don't make sense anymore.
One week makes a big difference for sure.
It does. But 590-590. We'll get to some of those. The game last night, we had different experience. You were stressed out and had to rewrite. I did my pregame stuff. Had a couple nice chats in pregame clubhouse.
Yep.
Did my Blue Jay Central thing, which ended up, being pretty relevant since I talked about Bo pulling the ball and pulling fastballs a little bit more over month or so. And then I said this in the air yesterday. I went and watched the game with a seeing eye dog in training. So my friend Eric and his fiance, they sometimes foster seeing eye dogs or train seeing eye dogs. So you have to, when they're puppies, they are just like with people who foster and train them until they're ready to go to like seeing eye dog school. So they have these rules. They have to get used to wearing the vest and not getting pet in the vest. And, you can't jump on the couch in this. You can't, run up to a random person. You just have to be way more disciplined training them. So yesterday was an interesting test. And we had done this before with one of his earlier fosters. Bella killed it.
Yeah.
She like one yelp at the start of the game because there was so much noise and stuff like that. And then just chilled until the air horn when the Blue Jays won, was not dog friendly.
I'd say that a low scoring game is probably ideal for a dog in training, but I'm glad. And we were even, I guess, speculating how long would she be in there for.
Yes.
Don't know if she had
extra innings in her, but she made the whole nine, which was great. So shout out to my friend Eric and to the CNIB who coordinate all of that stuff, helping train dogs for people who obviously need service dogs for sight reasons.
Must have been special, honestly, to do that and to be a part of that.
It's fun. It's also like we sat in center field, so we found a section where, first of all, you're on the aisle, and then there's like a little bit of space in front of you because some of the outfield seats have like their seats, but then there's like a little buffer zone, which is usually where like kids go and like ask for balls from outfielders and stuff like that. There were a couple kids in our section who were Phillies and Jays fans, like Jays jerseys, Philly hat. So they were playing both sides. They were like, Class A, Class A, Brendan Marsh. And they got a couple. There are also a couple adults in our section who got balls and didn't give them to kids nearby.
Wow. Which is, or to the dog, I guess.
Yeah, dog can't, gotta behave. You're on duty. When she's in the vest, she's on duty. So she can't play with the ball. But yeah, if you are an adult and there is a kid near you and you get the ball from a Major League Baseball player, my guess is the Major League Baseball player was trying to throw it to the kid and you just have more reach.
I would assume so. It's do the right thing.
Yes.
Give the ball to the kid. And before we get into the game stuff here, can't believe you outed me as a sire, as a heavy sire on air.
You that almost did it on air. Like if they had turned your mic on in the booth upstairs before you pressed the button yourself, which sometimes happens, the whole audience would have known.
Yeah, they would have seen or heard.
Also, probably the people listening are just like, anyone who has to work with Blake every day would probably expressively sigh a lot. Yeah. Probably a lot of eye rolls.
Is there a way to quantify how much that went up since we started working together for me?
Yeah.
Probably not.
I don't have the data set from before you got here, but all right. Speaking of familiarity, the Toronto Blue Jays walked off Jordan Romano and the Philadelphia Phillies yesterday. 2-1 victory. Very, very fun game. We'll get into some of what led up to that. But the most interesting thing here by far is the ninth inning. That included Jeff Hoffman getting the win because he got the final out of the ninth inning in a tie game. And then that sets up I mean, narratively beautiful. You had written about it for BlueJays.com the day prior about the Jordan Romano, Jeff Hoffman pseudo trade, right? The two closers swap roles. And then you have Hoffman in a tie game in a ninth, and then Romano in a tie game in a ninth. And Romano was fired up. So he touched 98.2 with his fastball at one point. His average velocity was 1.5 higher on his fastball and almost 2 miles an hour higher on his slider. He was fired up.
Yeah, he wanted this very clearly. And listen, you know, Jeff Hoffman clearly wanted it too, right? He didn't need to work as much. Came in, faced two batters.
Yeah, Brandon Little, 5 outs.
Yeah.
Working through those tough lefties.
Yeah, Brandon Little continues to put together a really surprising and impressive season, but Jeff Hoffman was the one who got out of that top of the ninth, and so he gets credited with the win there. It was clear how much these two guys wanted it, and Romano pitched well. It's not like he was, it wasn't egregious by any means. He just kind of got beat. It was a first pitch fastball to Vladdy, which he hit for a single, and then where he got beat, I guess, is on that stolen base.
Yeah,
right?
So let's go by batter by batter, because I think there's some interesting stuff with the Bo at bat as well, and it shows that the familiarity goes both ways, because Romano has a good idea of what Bo Bichette wants to do. He works him with 4 straight fastballs out and then backs him back up with a fastball in, and that sets him up for the slider low and away, which is, you know, Bo is chasing less than ever before over the last month or so, but still got him to reach out, and it's a weak fly ball. We also had, in that plate appearance, about the most uncomfortable injury stoppage you could see in a game as a dude.
It's unfortunate.
JT Realmuto taking a foul ball off the unmentionables, had to come out of the game for it. Seemed like he was going to be fine after the game. Yeah. Probably getting the day off today afternoon game.
Yeah. Maybe he was getting the off day anyway, right? I'm not too sure. I think he caught both of these games. And then if it's evening game, day game, teams tend to do that anyway to give the catcher a breather. But then that kind of just hammered it home. He's probably going to get the day off here.
Yes. Okay. So that brings up Vlad. And immediately, first pitch, Vlad jumps all over a fastball on the outer third, 116.5 miles off the bat. And yeah, it's on the ground, but you hit it that hard, you hit it up the middle, you're in pretty good shape. And I know it took a weird hop or whatever, but that was a rocket before the mound slowed it down a little bit. So then we have Vladimir Guerrero Jr. on first base. And who would know Jordan Romano's tendencies at the dish better than the Toronto Blue Jays? He was here for a very long time. His methodical pace on the mound was something the Blue Jays had to work with him on fairly consistently. From 2021 to 2024, he was the 8th worst pitcher in terms of how big a jump can a guy get when you go into your delivery. So not necessarily the lead off first base, because he has an okay pickoff move and he uses his step offs and things like that. But once you get into your windup, how big an extra lead can a guy get? Secondary lead, they call it. How much of a jump can a guy get? And that's where Jordan Romano was a bottom 10 pitcher over the last couple of years. The Phillies say they've worked on it with him and he's a little faster this year. Still a long way to go in Rob Thompson's estimation and in the numbers. He's still one of the slowest guys in the league. And teams didn't run on Romano a ton when he was here. Only 25 stolen bases over that 2021 to 2024 year.
Not bad.
But 25 for 29. In terms of effectiveness. So when they stole, they were very, very effective at it. So I don't know. I pulled the numbers. I was curious if league-wide teams just, run a little bit less in high-leverage spots because the risk profile is different.
Honestly, that's what came to mind.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I even put it in our group chat. And the numbers didn't bear it out. It's about the same in save situations as it is in other parts of the game. The only difference really is in low leverage. Once the game is decided, nobody steals bases. That was the only thing that bore out in the data, which was a little surprising to me. I would have thought teams were more risk avoidant in big spots like that.
So this is really just about the league sort of figuring out a guy like Romano, maybe getting to see him in a bit of a different market, a market that they're paying a bit closer attention to. Wow. And now this is what's coming out of it. And, you know, he's trying new things. He's trying to speed it up, but you don't just fix it within a few months.
And stolen base aggression is up around the league anyway, even like not even just from the new rules, like it's up over last year and that was up over the year before. But coming into this one, so I mentioned 25 for 29 stolen bases, 20 from 2021 to 2024, really good success rate, but not a high volume. Romano came into this one having already allowed 8 stolen bases in 22 innings. So the number's pretty high. And then, so Vlad knows this, the Jays know this, and the stolen base is really interesting because Romano throws the pitch 97 miles an hour. That's good. You want a fast pitch.
Yeah.
It gets to the plate a little quicker. The pop time behind the plate is 1.93, which is elite. Like JT Realmuto has the best in the league at 1.98. This is obviously the backup who comes in when Realmuto goes out hurt, and his pop time is better than an average JT Realmuto one. So really good job by the catcher. 83 miles an hour on the throw, which is really good. He throws it to the wrong side of the bag, which probably costs them here.
Yeah.
But in terms of what you can control, and he had to kind of avoid Romano with the throw there too. So threw it hard, not the most accurate throw in the world. But really this came down to, once again, the secondary lead Vlad was able to get. It was almost the top 10% of all secondary leads on any stolen base of second this year, stolen base attempt this year. And Vlad is not a fast guy, right? Vlad is not the kind of guy who, he's not Chandler Simpson. He's not going to just like 2 defensive slides and be gone.
I mean, that was his first stolen base of the year for a reason. We were all on the edge of our seats for a reason. I thought that they had a legitimate chance of actually getting him there. They didn't, obviously. Catcher did do his best. Kind of, and listen, Kirk spoke about it after the game. John Schneider spoke about it after the game. They know. They know what Jordan Romano is, what his delivery is, and the fact that he has always struggled with that side of the game. And so, familiarity does play a factor.
Yeah.
Someone who kind of downplayed the familiarity at the plate was Alejandro Kirk.
Yeah.
He's kind of saying that, it works both ways and all of that.
He knows Kirk well.
Yeah, and maybe we saw that from the at-bat against Bo as well. But I would say it's probably a bit different when you are a catcher facing a pitcher for the first time. He caught Romano for 82 innings, 82 major league innings. That is no joke, right?
No.
It's quite a bit of time for a closer, for a reliever, and a catcher to work together. He's more familiar than most with what Jordan Romano can do. And that was, again, in John Schneider's words, we've heard him say this so many times about Kirk, especially in these important situations. That was a professional at bat.
Yeah, really strong at bat. There was a Barger strikeout in the middle there, by the way. Vlad stole the base with Barger at the plate, and Barger worked it to a full count, but Romano got him on a slider that fell just out of the bottom of the zone. But the Kirk at bat is incredible. It's such a good example of a hitter who stays in there and just kind of like not outweights, but just wins the battle and makes a pitcher come to where he wants to go. So you have this, he starts 0-2. It's a called fastball, and then he swings and misses at a fastball in the top of the zone. And you're 0-2, and it looks pretty bad. And then Romano, like he did with Bo, comes inside with a fastball. I just gave you 2 up and out. I'm going to try to get you back upright so you're not leaning and looking for that. And that usually sets up a slider that's going outside of the zone away. He goes fastball first and then slider, and Alejandro Kirk fouls both of those away. Very defensive swings. The fastball was definitely strike 3 if he let it go. The slider was probably a ball, but staying defensive. Then he fouls off a slider low. Romano tries to change the eye level on him a little bit.
Yep.
So now Romano has tried to go inside to stand him back up. He's tried to get him to expand high outside of the zone because he had him, he had him looking up there and fouling off there. He's tried to lower the eye level and get him to swing and miss down in the zone. So Romano tries to go back up top now with the fastball. And for the first time in the plate appearance, he misses a little bit. It's not right on the edge. Kirk gets one that's a little more drivable and he takes it the other way. This is just such a, when you hear the term professional at bat, this is what it looks like. You get behind, you have a sense of what the pitcher's going to try to do with you in and out and up and down, especially with Romano, who with the fastball slider can kind of work 4 planes, slider for down, slider for away, fastball for up, fastball for in. And Kirk parries all that, parry is a boxing term, you kind of just brush it away and get ready to strike back. So he kind of parries all those, and you can see Romano hang the head after two. It's like just enough of a mistake, and not a mistake pitch, but like he just had to come in the zone just enough.
Yeah, it was impressive. It was impressive to see, and Kirk has put together a lot of those where it seems like he knows. It seems like he kind of knows what the plan of attack is, what is next. He is, you know, proverbially staying one step ahead, and you won't get him to chase, right? If it's way outside the zone, Alejandro Kirk is not going to chase, and that means that he is keeping pitchers in the zone. The last thing that you want is to walk a guy there, and then that kind of snowballs, right? You have two men on. Not that it matters at that point, because obviously you allow an RBI hit. That's it. But then you have George Springer on deck. So there was a lot that played into that matchup, and we're seeing Kirk do that consistently. He is one of the best two-strike hitters in the league. Mm. He is one of the best two-out hitters in the league, and that's because it's not just that he's not trying to do too much, right, Blake? It's also that he understands what the role is, what the plan of attack is, and the knowledge of the strike zone to me is still what's most impressive. Mm-hmm. Perhaps what's most impressive actually is how hard he's hitting the ball this year. He continues to hit the ball extremely hard, but he is not going to chase. He is not going to get out of his approach. And good luck to you, because you are going to have to come in the zone to get him out. And if you miss, what happened yesterday is going to happen more often than not.
Yeah, single-digit strikeout rate. So he's giving you a good idea that you're going to have to come in the zone there. And yeah, you mentioned the two-strike, two-out approach, hitting 370 with two strikes and two outs. And in clutch situations, so high leverage based on win probability swings and things like that, he a 195 weighted runs created plus. So he's been about double an average hitter in clutch situations. Now that's only 34 plate appearances. He's also got 12 RBI in those situations, which is almost a top 10 mark in the league. So even when you factor in, he hasn't seen a boatload of these high leverage plate appearances. He's not a guy who, because he's a catcher, he's going to take some days off and stuff like that. He's still almost in the top 10 in high leverage RBI, which is really nice. He's hitting over 400 in those situations.
Yeah, that's absurd. That's definitely a guy who's figured some stuff out. Last season was not great for him. The start of this season was, it just felt like it was going to continue. He was going to continue to struggle at the plate. Not anymore. He's not going to be a home run hitter necessarily. It doesn't have to be. The Blue Jays can find that power elsewhere for now. But yeah, what a development that has been. And just to go back on Vladdy, he almost lost his on-base streak yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
He took it to the ninth, and then he got that base
hit. If Bo walked it off, that was it.
That would have been it.
Yes. I kind of, like, narratively, it would have been really cool if Barger extended his home run streak with a walk-off as well. But it turns out Caleb Joseph is the only guy around these parts that can homer in five straight games.
Oh, wow. Caleb, if you're listening, we love you.
Yes. It was really fun talking to him about it yesterday. And him, like, obviously he remembers every pitcher he did against, but because he was a backup catcher, he did his five homer streak across four different opponents. We were joking a little bit, like, anyone can do it when you're in the lineup every day. Right. You're in a rhythm. You get the pitch. You get the hit against relievers. One of them came against the Blue Jays, Jay Happ.
Wow. Yeah. That's impressive.
Five games in a row with a home run as a backup catcher is like, that's probably as impressive as Griffey doing it eight games in a row as a starter, because like the ability to stay ready and I don't know, it's pretty fascinating. But Barger did not home run. Alejandro Kirk walked it off. Really, really fun. Up to that point, very little offense in this game. Pretty fun duel between Mick Abel and Jose Berríos. Neither guy was dominant, but they're both pretty efficient. Pitched to some contact. Low traffic other than Berríos' fifth inning. I know you would ask some questions because your plan before the walk-off was writing about Jose Berríos. Yeah. What did you see and what were kind of his thoughts on how that outing went?
Yeah, listen, the game plan with the way the Tuesday went was pretty evident. Pitch inside, right? And you mentioned it to me just before we came on here. It was clear that the Phillies were still geared up for outside, out over the plate pitches, right? So yeah, Berríos made it uncomfortable. I think he got out of the first inning with eight pitches, all strikes, something like that, and a ton of sinkers, and the sinker was moving so well. One of them did move, which was the Nick Castellanos.
Yeah, didn't get back in on him enough.
Well,
in the second.
You know what? he adjusted. He came back. He was throwing more slurves. He was throwing more changeups, and so, that set up the sinker again.
Also, right? It's the risk that you have to take, right? Is if if this team has for the game prior and they're coming out in this one looking for outside stuff, you do have to, and this is, part of the challenge when we talk about making adjustments in the game. Every time Bowden Francis tried to do that on Tuesday, he missed the spot, right? Yeah. He came in and it was a wild ball. He hit Nick Castellanos when he tried to come back inside. This is part of the risk is if you don't have the feel for it. And so Jose Berríos paid the price on that Castellanos one, but kind of stuck with it, reestablished the inner part of the plate, especially with that sinker. And then, that sets up, you think about a guy, if you're only pitching the other third, you can kind of be leaned over looking for that. Yeah. If you can brush a guy back with the sinker inside, stand him upright a little bit, then the slurve comes low and away. That's kind of the sequencing you're looking for there. So, I thought it was a really good, even the trouble Berríos got into in the fifth were like two walks, which, he's dealt with on and off this year. Kepler, he was like clearly, we just talked about trying to come inside, but Kepler as a lefty, like they were clearly trying to stay away from him. They didn't want to come inside to Kepler, righty on lefty. But the Real Muto single that extended that was like a tough ball to hit and really softly hit. And then Matt Marsh really battled. And then he got out of it with two weak pop-ups. Yeah. So even the one inning he got traffic, it was not traffic you can really blame him for. And he got out of it easy peasy.
Yeah. The easy peasy part is really what impresses me, because that wasn't just, two walks and a single. It was two walks and a single to turn the lineup over and bring in
Stott and Turner.
So it was a big deal and it was a big moment, and the game could very much have gotten out of hand right there. Even, as well as Berríos had pitched up to that point, if the offense isn't catching up on the other side, then every single out becomes so much more magnified. And this is something that we've spoken about at length as well, right? There's so much pressure on these Blue Jays starting pitchers all the time, it seems. And listen, we had a nice little stretch of runs scored in offense, and that was awesome. And then now they're facing very good pitchers again, and we're back to, 2 to 3 runs a game. It's been the fluctuation of a season for sure. And Berríos he's used to it. He's been here before, right? This is not new. It's not new for him. It's not new for Bassett or for Gausman, but to keep the poise, to actually make those pitches and to get the awkward contact, to get out of it, that speaks to more than just this start. It speaks to the mental resilience and frankly where his stuff is. He's on a roll right now, and that is why he's been also one of the best starting pitchers with runners on base. Mm-hmm. Usually gets out of trouble even if he allows those, batted ball, bad luck type of weird situations there.
Ideally, you don't have to deal with that as much. Yeah. Dan Schulman pointed out at the beginning of the Tampa start, three starts ago, that he was near the top of the league in how often he had to pitch with men on base, which is, you don't want to be consistently out of the stretch as a starter. But since that Tampa first inning, what are we looking at? 17 innings with only one earned run. The Castellanos home run is the only thing that he's gotten over the last 17 innings. So he is he's in a groove here. Nice little mix last night, and he needed, because Mick Abel was pretty good too.
I know. So what did you see from Mick Abel? I know that you kind of looked into him.
Yeah, I set him up pregame on Blue Jay Central because he's a pretty fascinating guy.
Did it kind of live up to what you were expecting there?
Yeah, a little. The one thing that didn't was the fastball velocity wasn't quite where. So in his major league debut, he averaged 97.3 on the fastball, and that looked like, in retrospect, he was fired up for his debut. Yeah. That's not how hard he threw in the minors. That's not how hard he threw last night. So it was a little bit, when you're a 6'5" guy with huge extension down the mound, if you're actually going to throw 97, like, that is an explosive fastball. Right. At 95, still, like, probably really, really tough to hit, but not quite the same. So it was down a little bit, so that part wasn't as fun. There's also, in addition to the adrenaline, in the minors, he had pitched with an extra day rest most of the time, as a lot of prospects do. We're not seeing Trey Savage pitch every fifth day and things like that. So this is one of the first times he'd done that. So I wonder if maybe the difference in routine. They also didn't let him go super deep in terms of pitch count. So maybe there's a thought there. It was interesting. It was very, very different from his Pirates start, where he got 18 swing and miss and almost all of it was in the zone. Here he was in the zone a lot still. So good. You're throwing strikes and things like that. But only 5 swing and miss the entire game. Just in the zone a lot. And that's good because, like we talked about yesterday, he struggled with walks. When he went down to AAA, he walked 7 over his 2 starts, even though he was striking everyone out. So that's obviously a point of emphasis for him. I do think as fun as he is and as good as he mostly looked, he might have got a little bit lucky.
I was going to say there were opportunities and you know, high expected batting averages and all of that throughout that outing.
He gave up 17 balls in play, and the average exit velocity was a hard hit ball, like 97.5, 98 miles an hour. If that's your average exit velocity, like, that's living dangerously. And some of that was on the ground, but he had 3 lineouts that were lasers. You know, one of those ones that Brandon Marsh was like, is it going to drop in? Are you going to get there in time? So the other interesting thing was, because his curveball was so good, we didn't get to see the kick change that he uses. So the kick change is like a new kind of thing where a guy will supinate his arm for the changeup, guys who aren't good at pronating, and it's kind of a different spin axis on the changeup. I got to dive in more on like how the physics of it actually work, because I can't throw a changeup turning my arm either way. But yeah, it's interesting. He had used it pretty effectively against lefties in his first outing. And in the minors, it's like his go-to pitch to get lefties out. And here he didn't use it at all. And I think either he didn't have the feel for it, or like when he was warming up, or the curveball was just so good he didn't need to go to it. But I thought that was interesting, because the Jays had 5 lefties in the lineup. I thought we were going to see it a lot.
Me too. But yeah, I guess he didn't actually need it. No. He was cruising. I think you're right. I think you make a good point when you say that maybe the Blue Jays could have generated more traffic even earlier on and earlier than they did when Bobichet got that triple. By the way, you had a very good vantage point of where that triple fell there. I thought it was going to be caught, to be honest with you, and I was a bit surprised, I guess, that it was scored as a triple. But you were right there. You were sitting right at that section in the outfield there.
Yes, you can even, if you Zapruder the film, you could see me and my friends Doc and Eric and the dog.
Wow.
You can see, and we could only tell, so Eric watched back the replay and then sent me the clip of it, because you can tell, you can see the dog in the like yellow service dog vest. barely. Like, I had to like slow it down and zoom, but you can see it there. Yeah, it was good. It's always interesting when you're like a front row in the outfield, because you lose the sight line of like immediately below the wall. So you kind of got to stand up and tip over to see if it's going to drop in. But yeah, great piece of hitting from Bo on that one. And again, that was pregame. I talked about the better job he's doing taking heat on the inner part of the plate over the last month or so. That wasn't a pitch on the inner part of the plate, but in general, he has been doing more taking fastballs and sinkers to the pull side, getting them in the air a little bit more. He's never going to be Isak Paredes in terms of pull it in the air. That all fields approach is an important part of who he is. But 5 of his 7 home runs over the last month have been to the pull side. You know, it's good to see that as an option, and him handling, because even when like early in the season, when the numbers weren't there, but a lot of the underlying stuff was, he wasn't handling elite velocity all that well. And if he was, he was taking it the other way for average. It was, you know, a 290 is good, but like an empty 290.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of extra base there. So to see him continue to do that, a couple of home runs like that lately, and now a triple like that, is pretty good. By the way, in the next segment, we're going to take some of your texts on the text line. So text us 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply. We will, whatever you're thinking about the team. Already people are doing weird stuff in the text line about, you know, should have signed this guy, what, trade this guy.
Yeah.
It is June 5th. We're not trading anyone yet. That's not how that's not how the timeline's going to work.
Yeah.
For any trade deadline ever.
My question about that is, why not? But okay.
Well, this is a point of frustration for me over the years, is that like, we know at least 5 teams that are going to be selling on July 31st. We know 7 or 8 teams that are definitely going to be buying. There's not a rule that says you can't do it now. And while if you're a seller, maybe your leverage is higher later in July when teams get a little bit more desperate and stuff like that. If you are a team that is purchasing, you get an extra 2 months of the guy.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Give me Taylor Ward tomorrow.
Yo, 100%.
No, before he cools off and is the worst trade deadline acquisition, because he's like the streakiest guy in the league.
Yeah. And listen, you know, also if you're a team that is buying, why wouldn't you want to get a leg up on the competition and just get a trade out of the way?
Yeah. And
I don't know.
Think about it. Like, if a guy, let's say you add a guy who you expect is 3 wins above replacement better than what you currently have.
Yeah.
That's a bit extreme, but let's use it as an example. If you get him at the trade deadline, you get one win of that three win based on how the schedule is. If you get them today, you get two wins of the three wins. If you got them at the start of the season, you get three. That's how, like, guys will be up and down. It's not going to be that clean. But in theory, you're going to get, like, sometimes we'll see teams trade, like, real prospects for, like, 10 innings of a reliever.
Yep.
You get 25 innings of
might
a reliever.
As well.
Like, we know he's been bad lately, so forgive this example, but he's a name that's been, like, we know the Marlins are going to trade Anthony Bender to some contender that needs relief help. Why the Phillies can't call the Marlins today to get Anthony Bender versus doing it on July 31st, I will never really understand. But the answer to most of the text line questions we get about deadline stuff, like trade stuff, is going to be
it's too early.
Just not
going to
happen now. Like this front office did when they did the Adam Simber trade. Mm-hmm. That was an early season one. But for the most part, like, unless you're Dave Dombrowski, like, everyone just kind of waits till July because it's what you do. It's not a satisfying explanation. But it is the explanation for, like, decades of baseball.
So get ready for those answers.
Yeah, no, we'll do more than just trade stuff, obviously, as well.
We'll get creative with it.
Yeah, there is some Spencer Turnbull stuff, some Aurelvis Martinez stuff. Amit putting the questions in the wrong part of the doc stuff. We'll rip him for that. Yeah, there's other stuff from this game, too. We'll get you set up for Jesus Luzardo against Chris Bassitt as well, which is a fun one. Don't let Jesus Luzardo's Saturday start against the Brewers fool you. I don't think he's going to give up 12 earned runs and see his ERA rise by a point and a half again. I hope he does, but I don't think that is likely. We'll set that up. We'll take your text to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. In the second half of the show, we got Michael Bauman of FanGraphs coming on. We also have Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer and Dunedin Blue Jays coach Ashley Stevenson joining us. All that's next, but your text to 590-590. Coming up next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL.
The J.D. Bunkus Podcast.
Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. We're going to do some text line stuff this segment. The first text comes from Blake in Toronto across the desk. And Julia, my question for you, this is hair related.
Okay.
You have had a run of great hair days every day. And your hair is curly and it has a bit of a semi-gloss finish.
Okay, yes.
It is not a matte finish.
Yeah.
It maintains that look of wetness, I guess, is it, for lack of a better term.
Just got out of the shower type of thing.
Yes.
100%.
So my question for you in the text line is, how does Brandon Marsh manage to remain wet for a full 9-inning, 3-hour baseball game where his hair looks soaked from the very start to the very finish?
That's a great question, and I wish I was in the Phillies clubhouse today to actually get an answer for it. Do you have a theory?
I do have a theory.
Tell me.
So I have asked, because I do some stuff in the world of professional wrestling.
Yes.
Where guys also look wet from the start of the match to the end of the match. I have asked. And what they do, and what I'm going to assume Brandon Marsh does, because I don't have another good explanation other than he pours water on his head every time.
That's what I was going to say.
Is wet the hair.
Yep.
And then put conditioner in and leave the conditioner in. So imagine you're in the shower and you condition your hair and you forget to rinse it out.
Yes.
And then you notice, like, 10 minutes later, and you're like, oh, it still looks and feels really wet. So that's what wrestlers do. They put conditioner in and not rinse it out. And that maintains the wet look for longer.
Is it leave-in conditioner, though, or is it normal conditioner?
I would imagine it's not leave-in conditioner, because leave-in conditioner probably protects against that, right? Like, you wouldn't market it as leave-in conditioner if it was going to leave you looking soaking wet all day.
Yeah. Listen, great question. I think that was the best way to kick off this segment. I'll take over from here and I'll ask you some more normal ones, if that's okay.
Yeah.
We're going to get it started here then. There is, like you mentioned, Blake, a lot of trade deadline questions. Let's start with Bob in Mississauga, and then I'll just work my way down here. But Bob in Mississauga texted in to ask this. Imagine if we had signed Pete Alonso instead of Anthony Santander. And then Bob himself goes, yeah, hindsight. I know. It's a weird thing. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, it's very early. Pete Alonso's awesome. It would have, you know, if you play out the butterfly effect of this, it's possible you are not seeing the Addison Barger breakout as well, because there are a few extra reps at third base that aren't going around, because Alonso would play first sometime. Like, Alonso and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. would probably split the duties at first base and DH for the most part, but you would see the odd Vlad at third base day. You'd also be playing George Springer in right field with a little more regularity. Mm-hmm. The defensive underlyings on George Springer's defense in right field right now are bleak. I know he's had a really great season at the plate, but a lot of the indicators there are he's lost a step or two on the defensive side. Offensively, you would be doing backflips. Right. Pete Alonso has 14 homers and 53 RBI already. You would be a different kind of team. Barger's probably in AAA a little bit longer because, you know, and Ernie Clement is, you know, at third base. Like maybe Barger still comes up when Jimenez went down, but he's certainly not as locked in every day. Probably doesn't get as much runway to figure things out, because you would play Vlad there a little bit more, or you'd be sacrificing your defense in the corner outfields a little bit more by having Springer in there. But it is fascinating. The other aspect of it is Pete Alonso is on effectively a one-year deal, because if he has a good year this year, he's going to bounce.
He has an opt-out.
Yes. Yeah. And he makes twice as much as Anthony Santander this year. So, you know, what did they... Ironic, this is not going to satisfy the answer, but if you go Alonso over Santander, mm-hmm. you probably don't sign Scherzer then, because that's that extra money there, and that's three innings you can't get back. Anyway, it is fascinating. It is, your offense is unquestionably better and more dangerous.
Yeah.
But there is more. A trickle down on the pitching side and the defense side, but yeah, Pete Alonso rocks.
Yeah, there's definitely more to consider, right, than just offensive production, which you know, there's urgency to it with the way that the season has gone for the Blue Jays, for sure. And you're going to look back at some of those things, and you're going to ask yourself what could have been. But you're right. Roster construction would have been so different. Outfield configuration would have been so different. The fact that that Vladdy and Alonso would have to sort of split the duties there. And then are we talking about Vladdy at third again? It's kind of an awkward.
Like, yeah, right? Like Vladdy at third is like a fun quirk, like a handful of times. He was quite bad when he was there before. And he has not, like, other than the ability to stretch and like have an okay arm, he's not like the best defensive first baseman. So I would be worried about how that would look on a more regular basis.
Yeah.
At the same time, Pete Alonso is one RBI off the league lead. So that's some nice power production there. Yeah. Pete Alonso rocks.
Yeah, hindsight.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on here. Frank in Toronto. Should Kirk be the Blue Jays cleanup hitter, or is it too much to ask when he's catching too? He was cleaning up yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, and we've seen him in that role on and off, right? George Springer has been the cleanup hitter as well, but I feel like over the past few games, we have seen Alejandro Kirk in that role a bit more. Where do you stand?
Five consecutive starts for Kirk. He's been in that spot. So, I mean, I don't mind it. Like, we're past the, with this lineup at least, like, we're past the idea of like a traditional cleanup hitter. Like, obviously, Kirk's not a 30 home run guy. He's not Kyle Schwarber in there where the Phillies have. But the way the Blue Jays are structured, that three spot, they're probably going to prefer a lefty against righty. Yeah. So whether it's Barger or Varsho, break that up a little bit. And then it's a coin flip between whether you want Kirk or Springer versus second. And, you know, if you have Springer ahead of the speedier bottom part of the lineup, less clunky on the base paths and things like that. I'm fine with it. Like this team is just not Vlad. You want Vlad hitting in the top three. You want Bichette hitting in the top three. They're your two best hitters. You want them getting up as much as possible. How you shake out 3, 4, 5 is more to me about who's hot right now and how do you make the late game decisions difficult for the opposing manager. So how do you utilize that one or two lefty to split things up and things like that? So yeah, I'm fine with that. I think it's five starts in a row. Kirk's hitting the four spot. So
yeah.
It's working fine. He's never going to be a 30 home run guy. It's just a different look offensively.
Yeah. Don't expect a ton of home runs out of that spot, but you can expect production, right? That's the main thing for a guy hitting in that spot. If you can create some traffic on the bases and you have Alejandro Kirk hitting, you feel really good more often than not. And so far, I would say it hasn't been a huge ask for him to catch and to hit fourth. So we'll see how things continue to progress. It's kind of an up and down season, and that's just the nature of baseball. We'll see how long this lasts. We were, you know, having similar conversations about Bo hitting leadoff, I guess, early on, and how long that lasts and how much of an ask that was. He's been fine as well. So
By the way, Drew on Twitter tweeted in and said that Brandon Marsh literally does just like re-wet his hair throughout the game.
Oh, yeah?
So I will keep. Okay. So we can't see it at the ballpark. So I gotta like lock in on the Phillies broadcast one of these games next series, maybe when it's in Philly and I won't be at the ballpark and see exactly what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that having long hair and a long beard and playing baseball, you must get hot, right? Simple
sure.
as that. So, yeah.
All right, what else we got?
Sorry, I did get a bit distracted because what are we talking about?
Yeah,
Brandon Marsh's
It's a baseball
hair.
Question. It's he had a very good day in center field yesterday.
You're not wrong. It is a baseball question. Okay, a more traditional baseball question here. Tyrone and Scarborough asking, this is actually kind of a controversial one. Why did this team trade for Andrés Giménez? Can you walk through that thought process? I've heard that a bit repeatedly recently since his return. Where do you stand on the Giménez trade at this point in the season?
Yeah, I mean, the justification for it is fairly straightforward. He is an elite defensive second baseman. That has, in retrospect, mattered a little bit less because Ernie Clement and Addison Barger have both hit enough to be in the lineup every day when Giménez is down. And Clement is obviously a very good defensive player at any position. But the way things looked, you couldn't really come into the season with Ernie Clement and Addison Barger or Relvis Martinez locked in as like everyday guys. They just weren't proven enough. And Ernie Clement had a really good season. You knew he was going to be on the roster, but you want to use that versatility of Giménez goes down, you can plug him here. Barger struggling, you can plug him here. So they needed an extra infielder. Now, Giménez in particular, the contract is what it is. The later years of that contract are going to be more of an issue than they are right now, and he's only 26, so maybe he can grow into that a little bit. But what they saw is like elite, like class of the league level defense mm-hmm. at second base. We already know, I asked John Schneider about how the defensive positioning changes in the outfield when you go from Dalton Varsho to Jonathan Clase last night and how that changes how you position your corner outfielders. And, you know, Varsho can take this risk. Mm-hmm. Varsho's better going to this shoulder and Clase prefers this shoulder. So it changes how you move your righty and lefty. And he mentioned unprompted that Giménez changes a lot of what they do defensive alignment wise as well, whether it's where Bo shades, whether it's where Vlad plays and things like that. Ernie Clement, a very good second baseman, but Giménez is in that tier of like, you can assume he will get to stuff yeah. that you can't assume of anyone else. So the defense is really strong. Obviously, it's been a small sample so far. And then the other thing, I know everyone's frustrated. He's hitting 201. He hit three homers the first 4 days of the season, and he hasn't hit one since. He literally hasn't hit one since March. there is enough underlying stuff that suggests Giménez should be able to get back to being a league average bat. And with that level of defense, hitting him in the bottom third of the order, you shouldn't need him to be like a 25 homer guy. You just need him to be adequate at the plate. He has not been that so far, but there's a lot of stuff under the hood that suggests he can get back to that.
And I would, just add to the point that this is maybe about more than just this season. This
yeah,
is about
he's 26.
Ensuring that that there is a competitive core in place now that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is signed and Alejandro Kirk was extended and Anthony Santander, again, a guy that we tend to we're obviously this is what's happening right now and that is what we're going to look at. But signing him is about more than this season. It's about maintaining that competitive window. And so, yeah, it's been frustrating for sure, but you have to think of the long term as well. Let's move on if you're satisfied with
yes.
that. Okay, so Ryan in Orangeville, even though Mick Abel was pitching well, the Jays didn't look uncomfortable or lost at the plate. They seem to have a plan. That looks like a change from a lot of points over the last few seasons. And Ryan was encouraged with the approach despite the lack of hits and runs. We did touch on it a little bit,
I think.
Yeah,
Abel got a little bit fortunate on some of the batted balls. The Jays hit really hard and only had five swing and miss the entire outing. Like Abel, think he's going to be a guy really mm-hmm. interested when Aaron Nola's back, what Abel could look like in the bullpen for them when you do gear it up to 97, 98, you drop one of the pitches and just kind of go fastball, curveball maybe. But yeah, the Jays had a pretty good, they're pretty on top of a guy in his second career yeah. start. Like they didn't strike out very much. They hit the ball hard. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah. And I guess my question to you is, when you watch the at-bats of this team now, even when they're not scoring runs or, creating enough traffic, Is there anything that you're noticing that is distinctly different from what they were doing early on?
Yeah, I mean, it's more individual guy basis. We know that they're a low chase team. They don't go outside of the zone a lot. They're a very good swing decisions team. We know that, you go through individually and that looks different. You know, with Bo Bichette, the chase rate is at a career low, but I outlined a little earlier. For me, it's more about he's doing a better job attacking velocity and attacking on the inner part of the plate, meeting it a little earlier so he can pull it. With Vlad, it's been a lot more on base oriented so far. Coverage, everything, not swinging at basically anything, even stuff in the zone. With Addison Barger, it's about getting to that big A swing, and yeah, you're willing to sacrifice some swing and miss, but the approach is still pretty good for a big swing and miss guy. So it gets, Alejandro Kirk's just a pro, like that's just a hitter-ish approach at the plate. Yeah. So it's a little different for each guy. In general, the Blue Jays are a very good swing decisions team, and they hit the ball hard. You got to dig into at the individual level, is this guy getting enough lift? Is this guy doing something against fastballs? But in general, I think, it's things have looked a long way from the Rays series, where the Rays attacked all the stuff that we know the Blue Jays are weak at, and the Blue Jays couldn't do anything about it.
Okay, we have time for a couple more, I think. So George and Regina came in with a very interesting one, and I have to say I missed this, so please let me know what you have to say about it. So what George says is, I'm curious what you guys make of Harper spraying a quote-unquote foreign substance on his barrel in the dugout last night. I'm pretty sure this is illegal. The fact that he hides it in the dugout instead of doing it in the on-deck circle confirms that he is aware. What is this about, Blake?
They are allowed to do this. It is like you see guys with pine tar. The spray is a cleaner alternative to pine tar. I don't know if pine tar is bad for you or whatever. A lot of the baseball brands market these sprays. You'll see it a lot if you play slow pitch or like even like men's fast pitch or whatever. You will see guys have it because no one's rolling. If you're rolling up to Greenwood Park in the East End with pine tar, and you don't even wear batting helmets, I'm gonna look at you a little weird. But yeah, it's grip spray.
Yeah.
It's allowed. I know it looks weird when a guy does it in the dugout, but it's the same thing as pine tar, just spray on. Right. It's a little cleaner. It stays on wet.
And that we see a lot of, actually, even when, say, a guy breaks his bat, he's going to take some time. He's going to spray the new bat. Yeah. That's not really. So if that's all that is, then great. Yeah.
I know. Who knows? Maybe Bryce Harper has a secret one that's like way worse. My guess is it's the kind of clean pine tar spray.
We can't have another foreign substances scandal in our hands, Blake. I thought those days were behind us with the whole spider tech situation.
Yeah.
I'm glad it was just pine tar spray, and we can all move on with our lives. I'll give you two more, and then we'll take a break. Okay.
Unless I'm really long winded, then we'll.
Oh yeah.
One.
In which case, we're never gonna. In which case, we're never gonna know which Blue Jay do you think could put away the most loony dogs. But the first one is Larian Keswick. I think that's how it's pronounced. Asking, what are the chances?
Yes,
the
Blue Jays pronounced Larry.
Stop it. God, this is a serious program. All right. Larian Keswick, what are the chances that the Blue Jays sign Bo Bichette to an extension during this season?
I think pretty low. Yeah. There's not a lot of track record of them doing in-season stuff. If I'm Bo Bichette at this point, I probably want to feel the market out. Like the last time you would have been able to feel out the market was coming off the worst season of your career when you were, and I know he wasn't a free agent, but you still have those conversations for as sure. an agent and stuff like that. I'd be pretty surprised. I think this is, if you play really well this year, we're all going to be in a better place than if you don't. And then we can have these, nice positive conversations at the end of the year. I'd be pretty surprised if it got done.
Yeah, he was pretty honest about it when Vladdy signed his extension and saying that they hadn't had any conversations on extensions with him. So don't think it's happening, but I also wouldn't say it's impossible that he comes back. I'm not saying that anyone is shutting the door on a Bo Bichette return. It just doesn't seem like it's going to happen in season, right?
I'm going to take the ball and answer one myself, by the way. Oh. Russ in Kingston had asked, what are your thoughts on how Vlad's looked at the plate? I know stat heads will say clutch doesn't exist, but every sports fan instinct I have says it's real and Vlad doesn't have it.
That's a good point.
First of all, stats heads do believe that clutch exists. Clutch is measurable. I reference Alejandro Kirk's stats in high leverage situations earlier today. Like, that's a real thing. We can measure it. I can touch it. I can tell you who's good at it, who's bad at it. And I can tell you, Vlad is actually slightly above league average in those situations. Now, how you want to define high leverage is going to depend on you. I'm using it, like Fangraphs has one that's based on the win probability and the situation in the game. So if you come up with the bases loaded, down three in the bottom of the ninth with two outs, leverage through the roof, right? If you come up down five, ninth inning, nobody on base, nobody, like that's nothing.
Yeah.
So when we measure that, Vlad is not as good in clutch situations as he is in non-clutch situations so far this year, but he's still better than a league average hitter in those situations. Now, as for if clutch exists, I think what he's referring to, what Russ is referring to is that with a few exceptions, clutch is not sticky. It's not predictive. Right. If you are really clutch this year, that doesn't mean you're going to be clutch this year. It's not a skill that you own forever. It's something descriptive. You did all that stuff. Alejandro Kirk is borderline top 10 in clutch RBI right now.
Yeah.
That does not necessarily mean Alejandro Kirk is a super clutch player forever. Now, I personally, where I veer off the typical stat head thing is, I actually think there are guys that do that. And like whether the numbers hold, like, you can't tell me that when I watched Red Sox playoff baseball during their prime years when I was in like high school and university, you can't tell me David Ortiz wasn't the most clutch guy to ever clutch. Like, I don't believe it. Jamal Murray turns it on to another level in the playoffs every single year. And we can measure that a little bit in that he scores way more in the playoffs. But like that level of clutch shot making stuff, even if we can't capture that and be like, that's a thing every single year, you can feel it. Those things are real.
Is Aaron Judge clutch? Because he hasn't performed in the postseason, right? But
no,
would you think of him as a clutch hitter?
No, and he is a very clutch hitter in regular season
there
stuff. So this is, anyway, Russ's question is fascinating because like Vlad is worse than regular Vlad, but better than an average player in that spot. So he's not, you know, he's not quote unquote clutch because he doesn't like step it up to another level, but he's not bad in those spots. And then we all are going to kind of define clutch differently, right?
100%.
Like, this is not the stat guy definition of clutch, but to me it's like the big moments that I remember, and that's not a statsy, that's a very unstatsy thing. But it's like, Edwin Encarnacion, Jose Bautista, I don't care what, like, they're clutch. Jose Bautista hit the bat flip, Edwin hit a home run to set that up, Edwin hit the walk off in the wild card game.
Clutch.
One clutch moment can lock it in. Now that's a playoff stuff. Like, I don't know if Alejandro Kirk's start to this season is going to lock him in as clutch for everyone forever. But yeah, anyway, it's a fun thing to kick around. So thanks for the question, Russ in Kingston. Thanks to everyone for the questions. We'll save some of the ones we didn't get to for future days, as long as they are, you know, they don't run out on time.
Okay. Just the last one. Just say the name, no explanation, no nothing. This one has no name attached to it, but which Blue Jay do you think could put away the most loony dogs?
I know which Blue Jay media member could. It's this guy. I'm not answering that one. That seems like a mean question to
answer. Why? Why is it a mean question? I was going to say Ernie Clement.
I guess Kobayashi is a small guy and is the hot dog champ, although he's no longer hungry.
He no longer feels the hunger.
I will decline to answer this one.
Wow. Okay, well, you know what? Next time we do this, I'm going to ask you again.
I'll think on it.
You take some time, you think about it, and, you know, we'll revisit. Yeah.
I'm moving it down in the doc to the saved questions part so that you can ask me next time. I'll crunch some numbers on it as well, and we'll see what we can do.
Let's think
about
it.
I'm way over time here. This is my bad going off about clutch stuff. Thanks, everyone, for the questions. We'll do it again next week. We'll keep sprinkling them in. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll talk to Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. We'll talk to Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer and Dunedin Blue Jays coach Ashley Stevenson as well. All that's in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Toronto Blue Jays beat the Philadelphia Phillies 2-1 yesterday. They'll settle it today in a work from dome day, 3:07. Chris Bassitt against Jesus Luzardo. So we now go to the Philly area to, of course, talk about the Edmonton Oilers overtime victory. We're joined by Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. Man, I got a kudos to you. An unbelievable description yesterday of the contrast in style and vibe of Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl after that goal. Good, well done.
I've always been a Leon Draisaitl fan. As a large, ungainly German-American, I've really identified with him. So I'm really happy to see him come good on the biggest stage.
That's great. So obviously, NHL Stanley Cup Finals, really great tournament. We have it all here on Sportsnet. Watch every game, et cetera, et cetera. Jamie Campbell is in a Connor McDavid jersey on Blue Jays Central last night. There's another pretty big tournament going on, a couple other pretty big tournaments going on. Michael, I know you're generally a big college baseball guy. Have you gotten to check out much of this year's NCAA tournament yet?
So I'm going to resent my in-laws over this forever, but I was at a family wedding in the middle of the woods last weekend. So I caught very little of it. I only got back on Monday night, got the end of Little Rock LSU, which almost turned into one of the biggest upsets in college baseball history. So, but I'm going to be glued to the television. I've disconnected my phone. I'm telling everybody, don't bother me this weekend. It's going to be all college baseball.
Oh, Michael, I love a good excuse to blame anything on the in-laws. So I'm with you. I'm with you there. Blake wouldn't
know. Sick wife brags, guys.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, it's harder, I guess, for us to follow along from here, but I'm always so interested in the NCAA tournament. I'm wondering for, someone who's coming in kind of new, what to watch? What are you watching for?
If you follow March Madness, hardcore baseball people will probably not appreciate me making this comparison right off the bat, but it's almost exactly the same thing. It's 64 teams. It's the first weekend is wall to wall. We've got on the ESPN streamer down in the States. I don't know what it's like up in Canada, but they have like the NFL red zone style whip around channel. They call it quad box. They go four screens, watching four games at once. And it's the same thing. It's what I love about it is that there's something good happening always. There's, the start times are kind of staggered. So there's one game that's late and close. There's one game, always a game that has a potential high draft pick. Last year we saw in the regional round, Chase Burns, who is the number 3 overall pick, up against Trey Savage, who you guys would know well. It was one of the best pitching duels of the season. There, I think back to, this was like 10 years ago, there was a super regional game between LSU and Oklahoma that was Aaron Nola versus Jonathan Gray. There was the same round a couple years ago, Kumar Rocker threw a 19 strikeout no hitter against Duke. So this is a stage for these top draft picks to really make their first impact in front of a national audience. And so that's a big part of it. But also you get guys who are going to be dentists in 5 years, going 11 for 18. You guys might remember I wrote earlier in the season about the two former University of Minnesota baseball players who were on Love is Blind this season.
Oh, wow.
And one of them had played in an incredible game between Minnesota and Oregon State. Max Meyer from the Marlins was in that game. Adley Rutschman. Nick Madrigal, Caden Grenier, Trevor Larnach from the Twins. Like, this was a star-studded game, and freaking Ben from Love is Blind, who can't decide how churchy he is hitting second in front of in front of this huge crowd at Oregon State, making a huge impact on the game. And so there's just this incredible variety of style of play, of talent, and I love it. It's one of the best baseball spectacles that you'll get. In many respects, it's better than the MLB playoffs.
We seldom do my interests collide so perfectly as they did just now.
Well, this is what Monday's show is going to be now. I'm going to be like, yeah, Jays swept the Twins, whatever. Which college baseball player will make the best Love is Blind candidate next time? There's a fascinating thing in the NCAA tournament over the last couple of years where, because of shrinking minor league levels, because of NIL money, maybe keeping greater talent pool at the college level, and Major League Baseball, because of those two factors, using the NCAA as kind of a development pipeline a little bit more aggressively than they maybe have in the past, we've had like a burst in guys making it to the majors within a year. And Paul Skeens is obviously Paul Skeens, and all the Angels guys are the Angels guys. They're just always going to get called up right away. But even Jack Caglione, who I remember you writing a piece early in the tournament last year about the kind of big home run battle that was happening in the NCAA, is already up, like less than a year after being drafted. So I guess, first of all, how excited are you to see Caglione at the major league level? And second, what do you make of that trend? Obviously, like, there's a lot of fascination in the dentist guys, in the Love is Blind guys, yeah. But there's also a chance a couple of these guys are going to be here this time next year.
I think that's always been a big draw at the tournament. I remember being, you know, being excited for, maybe this is a bad example, but Danny Hulston or Garrett Cole, you know, that's a better example, pitching in the College World Series final. And those guys are always fast to the majors. You know, that was a big deal, you know, when we were talking about Skeens versus Wyatt Langford in the final a couple years ago, that LSU Florida final, the individual games ended up not being quite as good, but it was, you'll see, like, there, if the Rockies play the A's, you will not see as much talent on the field as you would find in those games. So, like, Cags, I'm shocked he's up this fast. I thought he was kind of a raw prospect for a college hitter, but he's got as much power as anybody you'll ever see. Like I said, when he got called up, like, I don't know if the Royals have had a guy with this much raw since Bo Jackson. That's the level of power that, you know, and so we'll see if that translates itself to a bunch of 115 mile an hour ground balls and, you know, 200 strikeouts a year. There's a lot that's still left to iron out, but he's a guy who can make an impact at the big league level really quickly. And, you know, what you mentioned about shortening the draft, contracting the minors, NIL money, getting kids to campus and keeping them in school, that's made the college, the standard of play is just incredible. I was watching the Big Ten tournament a couple weeks ago. You know, I covered the Big Ten 50, about 10 years ago. And, you know, Jake Cronenworth, who's now, you know, with the Padres, was this unhittable closer for Michigan. And he was throwing 88-91. And so, you know, fast forward 10 years, Penn State was playing a game and their closer, you know, Penn State is just has historically been an absolute bottom feeder crap baseball program. They've got a closer who's thrown 96-97 now. And this is just like the talent gap between professional and college baseball has never been lower. And, you know, I think they're good and bad things about that, but it's a spectacle. You know, I definitely would encourage everybody to watch. You know, like I said, I don't know how you do that up in Canada. Maybe get a VPN, but
yeah, we'll figure it out.
figure something out.
Yeah,
you work for a major broadcaster. You know, get them to put this on.
Yeah, TV. Redacted is all I'll say about how I will watch these super regionals. But yeah, to highlight kind of what you're hitting, this is why it's so cool that Murray State made it through the super regional. So here's a stat from Kylie McDaniel that Ole Miss have 12 pitchers who average 92 miles an hour on their fastball. Georgia Tech has 8. Murray State has 0, and they made it through in that regional, which is it's pretty fascinating. Well, first of all, having 12 guys on a college roster who all throw 92 seems like there's a redundancy at some point. But yeah, Murray State's now this underdog because like they only have guys throwing 90-91. It's pretty fascinating.
I'll tell you one guy that actually had some time to develop in the minors. That's Mick Abel. Maybe not the minor league season that he would have expected last year, but he's cruising right now in 2 starts in the majors. Michael, how closely did you follow along yesterday, and what have you made of this very successful start to his big league career?
Yeah, I caught most of the game yesterday. And, you know, part of the reason he's taken so long is at the very beginning of the process that we were talking about was the pandemic, which wiped out the 2020 college and high school seasons, resulted in the most college heavy draft in history. And Mick Abel was one of very, very few high schoolers who got picked high in that draft. I think he might have been the only high school pitcher who was picked in the first round. And so Phillies fans have been excited about him. You know, you saw it yesterday, just, you know, big, lanky right hander, you know, killer breaking ball. And he's struggled to put it together. You know, it's been command problems. You know, he's gotten hit around a little bit as he's gone up to the rungs of the minor league levels, and he's just been unbelievable. Like one of the very first pitches I saw him throw was a breaking ball to get a strike out of. I think it was Addison Barger in like the third inning, and I just gasped. Like, it's incredible stuff, and I think the Phillies had relatively low expectations for him coming up just to make the spot start just because Aaron Nola's hurt and they, you know, the pieces shake out better if they work Taiwan Walker into the bullpen. He could be around for a little bit. Nola seems to be on a little bit of a longer term injury than maybe they had thought to begin with. And so Abel, you know, we'll probably make a few more starts. We could see him possibly as a, you know, medium leverage, possibly multi-inning relief option in the playoffs if the Phillies make it that far. So he's just been unbelievable. I can't imagine having 2 better starts to start your season.
Also, as you pointed out on social media, he checks another box of all the different types of names that could be shortened to Mick. He is McLean Abel.
Oh, wow.
McLean is his first name, so he goes by Mick. It's a lengthy list of different ways to find your way to Mick. So, Michael, you were watching that game yesterday. Do we send flowers to JT Realmuto? Do we send child? What do we do to pick
send
that guy?
Ice or frozen vegetables? I think that, you know, I don't think it's exaggerating to say that game turned entirely on that nut shot, because, you know, you have that delay. It gets Romano out of his groove. You know, you have Vlad stealing second off an ice cold Rafael Marchand. And that put him in position to turn that next hit into, you know, an uncontested walk off. And so, you know, I guess you take him where you can, or not in a JT's case. I hope he's okay. That looks terrible. That'll mess you up even if you are wearing a cup.
Sounded post game like he's gonna be fine. Like, I think Rob Thompson said he's had worse. I don't believe. I don't believe it.
This is a guy, like, he would, there's like up to certain calibers of bullet he could take and still like not even grimace. And just, I've never seen him make some of the faces that he made while he was trying to get up off the ground. Yeah. So, you know, best wishes to him in his convalescence.
Tough one there. Jesus Luzardo's going today. I know you're not just a Phillies guy, but you do watch the team a bunch. He gave up 12 on Saturday to Milwaukee, but he had been unbelievable prior to that. He actually had, FIP, fielding independent pitching, that's a stat that tries to measure just what a pitcher can control, walks, strikeouts, and home runs. So take the defense out of it. Imperfect, but it's a fun snapshot. Prior to that game against the Brewers, he had a negative FIP against left-handed hitters. It shouldn't be possible.
How does that even work? Yeah.
Talk to Appleman or whoever you got to talk to at Fangraphs, Michael, and have that one fixed. What have you made of Luzardo's season? Obviously, the 12-run game is that's an outlier to end all outliers, but he's probably been better than the Phillies could have expected, I'd imagine.
Yeah, you say that. He is really the perfect project for them, and he, they gave up a decent prospect to get him, but he was sort of viewed as a reclamation prospect. He's somebody that I've followed since he was in the low minors. I've just, lefties with that combination of command and velocity don't come around that often, and he has unlocked it in bits at every stop that he's made, you know, first with Washington and then Oakland and then Miami. And he was, you know, the Phillies bought low on him. And there are two things that the Phillies love. They love fastball velocity. They love guys who throw sinkers. And, you know, they'll teach you, they'll either teach you or help you refine your secondary fastball offering. And there is just no better lump of clay for the Phillies to dig into than Luzardo. And, you know, I don't know that I expected him to, you know, maybe supplant Zach Wheeler as the team's number one starter, which is what, you know, how well he was pitching early in the season. So, you know, sometimes when you regress to the mean, you regress all in one day. And I think that's what happened to him against Milwaukee. But he is the pitcher that I thought he would be when he was a prospect. It just took a little bit of a circuitous route to get there.
Speaking of pitcher we thought he would be, I think that's it's a weird segue, but bear with me here. You mentioned Aaron Nola and the injury. This is a guy who's kind of difficult to figure out. So much so, Michael, that you introduced a new stat in trying to quantify the ups and downs of the Aaron Nola experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And what is it that, you know, makes it somewhat of a frustrating experience to watch Aaron Nola pitch?
So Phillies fans, hate is probably, I don't want to paint with that big a brush, but they find Aaron Nola to be a frustrating figure. And I think some of that is personality. He's just sort of a soft-spoken guy. He doesn't give you, he gets compared to Ranger Suarez all the time, and Ranger Suarez, like, has no blood pressure. Like, he's so cool. And Nola is kind of a quiet, kind of nervous-looking dude. There are a couple things that make him frustrating. One is that he's got incredible command, and he throws a lot of pitches with late movement. You know, mostly the sinker, but also the curveball, changeup. You know, everything he throws is sort of geared toward nicking the edges of the zone. And when it's unhittable. And when it's not, it gets hard to watch. You know, you see similar complaints levied against Blake Snell. It's kind of that kind of situation. And so, you know, I got inspired by Andrew Arneberger, who is a, you know, writes about the Sixers in addition to music, who said that the thing about Nola is that you don't know if you're getting a gem or a dud whenever he takes the mound. And so I tried to quantify that using a very basic, you know, 1980s vintage stat called game score that you can get on Baseball Reference. I think you can get it on our site on the game logs. But, it, you know, basically you start with 50 points as a starting pitcher, you get points for doing good stuff, you lose points for doing bad stuff. And, you know, I took the game scores for every pitcher, for every start for the past 5 years, and tried to find the most and least consistent pitchers on a start-by-start basis. And what I captured, a lot of it was just variance year by year. The guys who were most consistent in that sample are guys with that, you know, Paul Skeens, Jacob deGrom, Trevor Bauer showed up because he's still in the sample. Guys who just haven't thrown a lot. And so, but on the other extreme, in terms of good pitchers who have a lot of variance on a start-to-start basis, Nola did actually turn out to be one of the least consistent guys. So, you know, I would have been really cheesed off if I had spent 2 days with my face in an Excel spreadsheet and it had disproved my thesis. But I think we got close enough that we got to quantify. And this has quickly turned into my beat at Fangraphs, is quantifying stupid things. So you know, feel free to peruse the site and go back. It's relatively recent, my blog role.
Yeah,
look, we need to update your title here when we introduced you then.
Yeah, as someone who made a stat called Primo for Andrea Bargnani back in the day to capture how he wasn't as good as some Raptors fans made him out to be, I can appreciate. I'm the inventor of the Adam Dunn hat trick. I'm not above very silly stats. That one was also particularly interesting because Bowden Francis and Eric Lauer both showed up in the top 10 in terms of inconsistency. The Eric Lauer one, maybe people just don't capture because he was in Korea and don't remember his time before that. He's been very steady for the Blue Jays so far. I don't imagine anyone will be all that surprised with Bowden Francis being on that one. Michael, the other part of your beat that I want to ask you about before we let you go here, you post a lot of photos of your cat commandeering your workspace. And this is an issue that I deal with as well. Whether laptop or desktop, the webcam is attacked. The monitor is paused in front of. The keyboard is just completely laid on. Do we have an engineering solution in the works for this? What are we doing about this, man?
I mean, we're feeding him four times a day. That's like my cat's had at his peak, he was 23 pounds. He's down to 17 now. So, but like he could carry that 23 pounds. He's huge. And this is part of the problem. But he was right up on the desk right when I was signing on. But the good thing is we've been doing this together, Ollie and I, for so long that he knows what a podcast or a radio hit is. And so as soon as I plugged in and took the microphone down, he scurried off into the corner. You might have seen him running around in the background.
It's camera shy. But...
So I have the exact opposite problem where like my setup has a webcam on the top of my monitor. And like the second I sit down and I'm ready to go, it's time to start swatting at it. Time to knock the webcam off. Work time's over. It's a difficult life we live, Mike.
Yeah. Can I plug one more thing before I go?
Buddy, you can plug five things if you want.
Okay, so we're doing a thing that starts the week of the 6th, the fan exchange. I wanted to make sure I said that, you know, since I'm reaching this new audience. I'm basically challenging baseball fans to watch a different team for 1 week, the week of June 16th. So if you go to Fangraphs and look for the fan exchange program, you'll find the explanation, what team I want you to watch based on what team you follow, you know, how to participate, what the survey, you know, there's a survey there, you know, basically I want to see how looking at a different team changes people's perspectives on the team they watch every day. So if that sounds interesting to you, please participate. I'll be spamming it all over social media, so it won't be hard to find, I promise.
Yes.
But so I just wanted to get that out there.
That does sound very interesting.
Check that out on Fangraphs, and it's particularly interesting that Jay's got a good draw here, where if you are a Blue Jays fan from June 16th to 23rd, Michael's asking you to become a Braves fan. Pretty fun team to watch. The Anthopoulos connection, Ronald Acuna Jr. is back. And then the fans that will be taking over for the Blue Jays are my favorite fans in baseball, New York Mets fans, who are so broken and appreciative of funny, bad, and, you know, anxious when things are good. They don't know how to accept it. Mets fans rock, and Mets fans are the ones who are taking on the Jays. So we'll have to have you back on when when that week is up and you have some of the results from the survey.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael. Really appreciate it, man. Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. Make sure you check out the Fan Exchange survey. Make sure you check out all of his great work over there. We got a lineup, by the way. I mentioned just how dominant Jesus Luzardo has been against lefties.
Yes.
This year, the Toronto Blue Jays are answering by starting zero.
Wow, really?
Zero lefties. Zero. They are going the seven righties who are on the roster, are hitting 1-7, and then Jonathan Clase and Tyler Heineman, who are both switch hitters, will round it out at 8-9. That means Alejandro Kirk is DHing. That means a down day for Addison Barger, Alan Roden, Nathan Lucas.
Andrés Giménez.
There's the other one. Thank you.
No worries.
And David Schneider's back in there hitting sixth.
Wow.
So that's interesting. You don't often see it this extreme.
It's extreme for sure.
I saw a fascinating one last week where the Nationals did the opposite of this, and they started nine lefties. Because they have a bunch of switch hitters. Most rosters wouldn't have enough lefties to do that, but they have enough switch hitters that they started nine lefties in a game. Pretty crazy. So the Jays will have seven righties and two switch hitters in there. I would imagine that means if they get Luzardo out of the game, we're going to see a lot of pinch hitting today. The Phillies only have two lefties out of the bullpen, and Matt Strom pitched yesterday. So you're probably going to see some righties come in out of the pen, and you'll see, certainly I'd imagine Barger's kind of first up for a pinch hit, but you could see Roden, could see Lucas. Certainly could see Giménez as a late game defensive replacement, although this might be part of his ramp up plan as well, that he's returned, that he just gets an off day here. But interesting lineup nonetheless. And yeah, Kirk back in that, to the person's question earlier on the text line, back in that cleanup spot. So six consecutive starts in the four hole for Alejandro Kirk.
He's earned it.
Yes. Let's take a break. We'll set you up for Jesus Luzardo against Chris Bassitt a little more. We will also talk to Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer and Dunedin Blue Jays coach Ashley Stevenson after the break. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz. I bet you were expecting Blake's voice, but we're mixing it up for this last segment. Blake is taking a break tomorrow, so I need to get used to doing this. Anyway, Blake, thank you for letting me take the reins on this one. We're going to talk to a Canadian baseball legend. I think that's pretty fair to say. Ashley Stevenson joins us now. Dunedin Blue Jays coach, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer. Ashley, thank you so much for doing this ahead of a Hall of Fame weekend here.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, so what has the experience been like? I know you were in Vancouver last year. You're in Dunedin now. Can you talk a little bit about sort of that move? And more importantly, can you talk about the Gil Kim manager experience?
Yeah, I spent 2 years in Vancouver. And you know what? They do an awesome job there. The city really supports that that team. And, you know, you'd have 3,000 to 6,000 people at every single game. Nooners at the Nat are pretty special. So it was a really fun place to kind of kick off my pro coaching career. And then Dunedin has been really an awesome experience for me. I've had an opportunity to be at first base, you know, for most of the season, with also getting my feet wet at third base. So that's been a great opportunity for me. I'm still working with outfielders, kind of taking the lead on a lot of base running stuff. So I've had some really nice autonomy over some things that we're trying to do, which has been excellent for my growth and development as a coach. And it just shows like a lot of faith that the organization has in me, which is always really nice. So it's been a lot of fun, certainly a lot warmer. but Dunedin's been awesome. They really do love and support the Jays, you know, starting with spring training, and then it carries out throughout our season. So it's been a great start to the season there.
With respect to the move to getting some reps at first base and working with the base running, what goes into the prep with that? Like, obviously, we know in the Florida State League, stolen base attempts are much, much higher than they are in the majors. What kind of goes in from like a prep level for you personally and in getting the hitters and the base runners prep for that day starter or that week's opponent?
At the beginning of every series, we kind of we have like a base running kind of chart. It's our information that we would have for available to our players Without getting into too much of the nitty gritty, obviously the times to home and a catcher's pop time. So we know all the catcher's pop times. We know the pitcher's time to home on their fastball, breaking pitches, et cetera. We're going to try to find counts that they like to throw certain things in, trying to find tips or tells, like picking pitches, basically what everybody's trying to do, especially at the major league level now that nobody even gives signs anymore. So, you know, we still have that. We can still pick those things. Everybody's doing it. We're no different. But honestly, it's just tons of video watching to try to just find tendencies, if it's a possibility to find tendencies. And I mean, some people are really good and there's not a lot, and you're just going to, you know, your base stealers can steal bases, but other guys won't have the same opportunities. But if we can get a tip or a tell or something like that, and we can get guys an extra 90 feet, then we're going to try to use that to our advantage. But most of it is a ton of watching video pre-series. The nice part, I guess, about the minor leagues is like you got them for six games. Mm-hmm. So you're going to see a reliever 2 to 3 times. So that's helpful too. But yeah, like, and then honestly, so much about the our level is getting players to understand and learn like when a good time to run is, when we want to be aggressive, when we might not want to be aggressive, what we're looking for, you know. Even some pitchers, you know, you look at different parts of the body. Like when you're young, people are always like, oh, look at the heel and whatever, right? Like sometimes that's not the case on certain guys. So we're just trying to get them to learn and develop base running skills so that when they move up, they can kind of take that with them and continue to grow. So a lot of like development type of stuff at our level.
I'm wondering how much that sort of overlaps with the work that you do with the national team, which at this point, it's obviously also a very young team. You know, where does that, I guess, familiarity or where does that prep work in the minors come in handy for you with the national team?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the biggest difference, obviously, is like the amount of video and access to information I have. So like at a pro level, even at, you know, low A, there's just a ton of information you'd have on these guys, especially if they're coming out of the college ranks. Like we would have information from their college days too. So you can find more tendencies just because if you watch video, everybody's got them. So whereas in the women's game, honestly, it's advantageous to have people who've been around to see the same players, because lots of the same players, the best players are there year after year. And then you're able to, you know, kind of go off things that you know. But most of what you're going off in the women's game is like your own stopwatch, your own feel, and a game situation type stuff. I guess a large difference too is at an international event, like you're just trying to win. There's no player development happening at a World Cup. You're trying to win the World Cup. Whereas right now, like our primary goal is player development. So if a guy, you know, is stealing bases at a 60% clip in the first half, we're willing to live with that as long as the growing pains, he's demonstrating some like growth potential and he's learning. We're at a World Cup, like if we're stealing bases at a 60% clip, like we got to shut that player down probably or pick better spots just because they're not adding a lot of value to what we're doing. So I think that's kind of the difference too, a win at all costs kind of thing, as opposed to a development focused type of process and in the minor leagues.
Yeah, that sounds obviously like just, you know, different objectives, of course. And I wanted to ask you one more about the national team, Ashley, before we get into Hall of Fame stuff, but you know, you played for that team for a long time, and just more, I guess, on a personal level, even on an emotional level, really. I'm wondering what it means to you that you were able to stay involved and to sort of help this next generation of Canadian talent.
I mean, that was huge for me. I played for 15 years, and, you know, Andre was my manager for all 15 years, and I was pretty clear to him that after I finished playing, I wanted to coach. And I didn't know if I'd be given an opportunity immediately after playing. Some people like a little grace period, and some coaches sometimes want a player to have a grace period. I didn't want that. I wanted to go straight into coaching. And I'm thankful that he gave me that opportunity. He trusted me to go straight into it. So that was huge for me, that I didn't have to take any time off. I could still be involved with the program. And then, you know, to continue to be at the World Cups, like that's the pinnacle for our sport. And, you know, like women train, girls train, you know, all year for that opportunity. And they only come around every 4 years. So the time and energy that they put in is huge. And it, honestly, in a lot of women's sports, it goes unrecognized. And so for me to still be able to be a part of it and to try to help them and to help the program, like they've been, Baseball Canada is amazing to me. I don't have this opportunity with the Jays without them. And I've said that right from the beginning that they've been huge for my career. And I love every minute of playing for them for 15 years. So I was really thankful that I was able to help coach immediately after my career. And now it's brought me this opportunity with the Jays, which is, I mean, if you had told me this when I was 7 or 8 years old at a World Series game, I would have thought you were insane. And honestly, 5 years ago, if you told me this, I would have thought you were insane. So, so super thankful for that.
Yeah, it's the obviously, you know, you were a pioneer with that team, right, Ashley? And it's what's led you to be the first woman inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, which is a huge accomplishment. You told me last year that you were the first. You definitely were not going to be the last. Well, we have two more women being inducted this year. And I wanted to focus on Amanda Ace. What does it mean to you to see Ace get posthumously inducted into the Hall of Fame here?
I mean, Ace was the best kind of teammate that you could ask for. I didn't know anybody who didn't love Ace. Like, first of all, she was an unbelievable player. So, like, from a standpoint of, like, we got to find ways to win games, like, she's going to help you win games. She could play multiple positions. Her bat was electric at all times. And she was just, like, a student of the game. She was so smart, understood things, understood, like, nuances all the time. But then was, like, played so hard, but found a way to have fun, found a way to connect with all her teammates. Yeah, was just like the best kind of teammate that you could ask for. Like, some people are just so driven, they have a tough time connecting with teammates. Some people, you know, love it so much, but they're not win at all costs. Like, she kind of had the beautiful balance of both, where she was just such an unbelievable competitor, but had a side that every single one of her teammates knew her, like, loved her and knew that they could go to her for anything and she'd be helpful. So this is, you know, obviously this was going to happen one day. I could rip off 4 or 5 names that are going to be in here the next few years that are so well deserving. But I'm glad that Ace is finding her rightful place there. And I'm really excited to be there to see it on Saturday.
Yeah, it's. I was going to sort of ask, you know, on the field, off the field, what is it that you remember most about her? But it seems like it ends up blending into one, because from what you're saying, she was just one holistic person type of thing, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, so the best part, like the best way I could describe it, she's from BC, I'm from Ontario. At Nationals, we would be, both of us, extreme competitors. We would go at each other on the field, like at Nationals, like go at each other. People would think we hated each other. But I was like, we both wanted to attack because we knew the other, like, just didn't want to lose. Like, there was no giving an inch. And the only way we would win is if we found a way to bring her down somehow. And so it was like, and she never backed down from that. I love that. I love that competitiveness about her. Like, we had a few players on our team, and I think that's why we were so successful. Luch was another one. She'll be going in a couple years. And, like, we just had a few of us, like, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it, because, like, we loved it so much, and we had so much fun competing against each other. And then we knew in a week we'd be wearing the same jersey, just ready to just, like, throttle somebody else on the other side. And but yet, like, off the field, we're talking about hockey. She played hockey at Brown, then she played hockey at UBC, you know, like, was doing all kinds of things in her community in Nelson to help grow the women's game. You know, all kinds of stuff, like had the best sense of humor. Her aunt would come to all our World Cups. Her parents would be at everything, like, this, like, salt of the earth people, the nicest people, and an absolute fierce, fierce competitor. It was the most fun. And when I transitioned to coaching, she was still playing that one year. And I remember, like, I would run things past her, And I never felt like she was judging me as a new coach, or never felt like she thought I didn't know what I was doing. Like, it felt like just such a great relationship. Like, she was glad to be included, and she was such a great baseball mind. It was silly for me not to ask her questions. And Andre gave me that opportunity as a young athlete and a young player, and to develop some leadership skills. And obviously, You know, she was our leader, our captain at that time. And so asking her questions and involving her was easy, but she just made it feel so seamless. Like, she just did such a great job of making everybody feel like, you know, they were so important and, you know, they were critical to our team's success, even though, like, she was probably the most critical to our team's success. But she had a great way of bringing everybody in. And I think that's why everybody loves her.
I actually covered the UBC women's hockey team the year after she finished there, and her name would come up a lot from younger players in terms of, you know, who had the influence, who had the leadership kind of before. It was a very, like, transitional year when I was covering them. And yeah, her leadership was still very much felt with the team that kind of followed after. So it's cool to hear this side of it as well about her.
Very much so. And it's going to be a special weekend, right? There's just no doubt about it when you have someone of that presence being honored, Ashley. And not to put the spotlight too much on you, because I know that maybe you don't love that, but I am wondering what or how you remember your induction. Is there anything that from that whole process, from getting the call to making your speech, that stands out to you still?
Yeah, I mean, I got the call and I was at school, which is fitting because like, like, I don't know how many times I asked for time off to play baseball and compete and whatever. And like, this is just a huge part of, you know, of my life too, and making both sides of it work, right? Like, so many female athletes, you know, they're elite athletes, but they're also working like a normal job or a typical job to pay bills, because there's not the same level of support or pro sports. So it was kind of fitting that that's where I got my call from Scott. And I mean, I was not expecting it at all. I honestly thought he was calling to ask me for like a pair of cleats or a jersey for like, you know, International Women's Day or something like that. And then he told me, and I was just silent. I thought, I was like, this is a bad joke or something. And he was like, you have anything to say? And probably said a couple cuss words after that, which is in typical fashion. And yeah. And then we just chatted for a little bit, and I remember hanging up the phone, and he said, like, it's supposed to be a secret, please don't really tell anybody. So I told my wife only, and I didn't even tell my mom, because I was like, she's gonna tell her sister, and then my aunt's gonna tell everybody she knows. So I was like, I'm not even gonna tell anybody. I waited, I was respectful, but sat there kind of quiet by myself for a few minutes and just like thought about my baseball journey and career. And like, I always played because I just loved it so much. Like, I still love the game so much. And I never, ever thought that I would have these opportunities. Like, when I started playing catch with my mom and my dad and T-ball, it was because it was fun and it brought me so much joy. And at 40 years old, it was still bringing me so much joy. And, you know, to then be remembered or inducted into like the Hall of Fame, like, that was just, I sat there for a few minutes really speechless and wondering how I got there. And I mean, I got there just because I loved it and I kept playing. But it was really, they do such an amazing job, and it was a really special week. I just remember thinking, don't trip on the way up to the stage, like, just don't fall, and try to say something that was like kind of funny, like, just don't cry the whole time. So I was like, just try to share some stories and have some fun and enjoy, and just enjoy the weekend. Like, you know, people are worried about the speech and have all the nerves, but I just really tried to enjoy the whole weekend. They did a great job. It was really fun.
And then just zooming out, I guess, before we let you go here, you know, as you get there and you're inducted and now you're seeing more women join you and you're seeing still the evolution of this national team, how proud are you of not just yourself, but the women that were with you in this pioneering role, the women that are on the team now? How far have you come, really?
Yeah, like, in my speech, I gave shout outs to people that I started playing with who were unbelievable players, maybe a little bit older than me. And so unfortunately, like, missed their time. I played with them like provincially and locally, and like outstanding baseball players. And I think of how like they changed the women's game, like how good they were, and also like how they impacted me. Like, I was a young kid, played because I loved it, had a little bit of talent. And then I saw like what real talent looked like and what real hard work looked like and what I needed to get to if I wanted to be on a national team and if I wanted to stay there for a while. And they just helped me so much on and off the field. Like, the greatest group of women that I had the pleasure of kind of going through those young, like those late teen years and into my early 20s. And some of them, even after Pan Ams, when I played, a couple of them messaged me and said, man, imagine if we had had that 10 years ago, like they would have had that opportunity, and how, you know, proud they were that I stuck with it and I kept going. And, you know, they're really happy for the opportunities that I've had, but, you know, a little bit sad that they missed out on those opportunities simply because, you know, I was born just a little bit later, just late enough to capitalize on that. And they didn't have that opportunity. But, you know, in all of sport, women's sports, it's like that. Like I played hockey growing up as well. And you think of like the Angela James is like, I mean, she's getting some flowers now, but years ago, people didn't really talk about her that much. And she, her and the Geraldine Heaneys and stuff are the people who just had unbelievable careers and put the face of, you know, were the face of women's hockey. And same with basketball. Like you look at Caitlin Clark now, and all the amazing things she's doing to help basketball, but the Dawn Staleys and stuff like that who came before her, and you know, she's doing an amazing job as a coach, but as a player, the career she had and stuff. So there's always pioneers, and you know, I think that we got to continue to talk about them and the amazing things that they have done to change women's sport. Like I was a small part of it, and in 20 years, people will forget who I am and they'll be the next person coming along. But that's exactly what it's supposed to be, the next person coming along to help change and improve the game. And I'm happy to be a small part of it. But I was really, really lucky to grow up with a great group of women and baseball players. And they were my mentors and my friends for a long time. And we still keep in touch. So, yeah, I mean, just really lucky.
That's awesome. It's always nice when we get to shed light on the women's game as well, which is why we're so appreciative. Thank you so much for doing this. We hope you have a ton of fun and get to catch up with everyone. Appreciate you very much, Ashley.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
There she goes. Ashley Stevenson of the Dunedin Blue Jays, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer. That was a pretty cool chat.
Yeah, that was fun. The women's side and the Hall of Fame side is, and I didn't even realize with Ace that like I totally blanked that. I was like, oh yeah, I would have definitely written about her at UBC the year that I covered the UBC women's hockey team. So I worked for the athletic department. Right. So I did basketball commentary and I wrote about the women's team, and they had like the biggest single season turnaround of success in like the history of Canadian women's college hockey.
Wow.
And yeah, her name would come up, be like, yeah, like we started planting the seeds last year. Like we knew by the end of the last season. Anyway, so it's cool to see that come around. As much as I would have liked to be just like, how did Manuel Beltre get so good at stealing bases? Is that all you? Is that why he's so good at stealing bases now?
Probably, yes.
Yeah, I doubt very much she would have answered that way. But yeah, fun chat. All right, we got a game at 3 o'clock today. We're gonna work from dome. It's gonna be Jesus Luzardo against Chris Bassitt. Jesus Luzardo, touched on him a little earlier. He did give up 12 runs to the Milwaukee Brewers on Saturday. Rhys Hoskins got him two times. Prior to that, though, he had a 2.15 ERA this year. It's now up to 3.58 after that one game. 3.34 expected ERA, so good underlying numbers. It was very good in 2022-23. Rough 2024, as Michael laid out for us, a bounce-back kind of buy-low gamble on the part of the Phillies. Solid amount of strikeouts. Doesn't walk a lot of guys. Gets some good chase and swing and miss, and then solid but not elite batted ball stuff. So he seems, profile-wise, he's a guy that's like, he's right there. Mm-hmm. There's like, nothing's elite, but nothing's that bad, and you're like that close. And sometimes you can get 12 runs in an outing with that. But 96-mile-an-hour fastball, and then he'll go changeup, sweeper, slider, sinker to righties. And we only need to focus on righties because he's not going to face any lefties today. As I mentioned a little earlier, the Blue Jays stacking the lineup with 7 righties and 2 switch hitters who will hit from the right side. So no lefties for Jesus Luzardo and his absolutely monster numbers against lefties. 2 Blue Jays have seen him before. George Springer is 2-for-6 with a homer. Miles Straw is 1-for-7 with 3 strikeouts. They're both in there today. Chris Bassitt has seen a ton of the Phillies.
He comes in
with a 3.80 ERA. Rough go the last two starts. 10 earned over 9 innings in his last two starts. He'd been a little hard on himself there, but on the season still what you expect from Chris Bassitt. 3.80 ERA, good strikeout rate, good walk rate, good ground ball rate. All the bones are still there, but the Phillies have hit him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he did play a season for the Mets,
yeah.
So that makes sense that a few of these guys would have seen a bit more. this is anything but a get right day for Chris Bassett. I'll tell you that.
You'd
much.
Hope so, but it's a tough one. Kyle Schwarber 7-for-16 with a pair of home runs against him. Brandon Marsh is 3-for-8 with very wet hair. Nick Castellanos 10-for-31 with 5 extra base hits. Tons of sample there. Bryce Harper's only 1-for-11 though, so maybe Chris Bassett can get through the Bryce Harper chunk of the order there. Should be a fun one. 3 o'clock game. We don't have a Phillies lineup yet. I'll be very curious if JT Realmuto is in it. He is usually an everyday guy. Speaking of catchers, Jays maintain a little catcher depth. Ali Sanchez cleared waivers and was assigned outright to AAA, so he'll remain in the organization as a call-up. That's it for today. Thank you to Michael Bauman and Ashley Stevenson for joining us. Thanks to Amit Mon, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Julia, I am off tomorrow, so it's you and Sho Ali here.
That's right.
At 10 a.m. I hope you guys have a wonderful show and Friday and weekend. Listeners, hope you have a wonderful Thursday.